Time now for Outsiders. I'm Barry Cassidy and you're not.
Thanks, Barry. Joining me for Outsiders this week, Professor of Economics at RMIT, Sinclair Davidson, author, writer and co-curator of Women of Letters, Michaela Maguire, and also Editor-in-Chief of the Canberra Times, Jack Waterford. First off this morning, this week finally saw the repealing of the carbon tax. Here is just a little sample of the action.
A useless, destructive tax which damaged jobs, which hurt families' cost of living, and which didn't actually help the environment, is finally gone.
It is a monumental blunder for this nation under a climate-denying Prime Minister.
If you want the carbon tax back, if you want to pay more than you should again, it's quite simple. You just put Mr. Shorten into government and you'll get it back.
He will try and do and say anything to avoid the science of climate change. He still believes, as he famously said, it is absolute crap.
Climate change policy. It's contributed to the demise of successive leaders in Australian politics in recent years. Howard in 2007, then Malcolm Turnbull, then Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard. Why has this issue been such a tough one for our politicians? Why has it always been political suicide? Sinclair Davidson, if I could start with you.
Good morning. This has been a case where everybody's been too happy to argue about the science and carry on about science and not actually look at the policy. And what might be good science doesn't automatically translate into what is good policy. And I think our political classes have really failed to explain the policy implications of the climate change science. So we heard in that clip there, it's all about the science. Well, no, it's actually about the policy and the policy which people want and are prepared to put up with. And it turns out that the Australian public didn't want the policy that they got and haven't liked any of the policy propositions that they've heard. And that's why we see ourselves in the position we're at today, where we've actually got no policy and we've still got a lot of science.
Jack Waterford, has it been a failure on behalf of the politicians or a failure on behalf of the policies which they've been armed with, or they've armed themselves with, I suppose?
I think there's a really good room for a big debate on the policy because we haven't really had it. There's, if you like, a question mark of whether we must do something, but a tendency to believe that whatever one side is proposing or the other is something or that something or the most effective something, when it seems to me, say that in relation to the just abolished tax, there's a good argument that Abbott massively emphasised the bad parts about it and that the proponents of it massively overemphasised the good and effective parts of it. In fact, I think the real problem is to some extent the politics, the fact that it was left to the scientists, that it was left to the bureaucrats, possibly even to the interests and the politicians themselves, rather than the public was brought along with the emerging debate and the serious questions that was raised. Now, you know, back in 2007, there was very definitely a majority of the Australian population wanted, quote, something done on climate change. I suspect there's still a majority there today. But the Labor Party in particular dropped the ball of advocating and keeping the issue as a forward order one. I think it's only now that they've actually realised that this has become for them a critical issue of does the Labor Party actually stand for anything, that we might see them trying yet again to mobilise public opinion and to galvanise some sense that there's some urgency about what has to be done.
Well, it certainly now makes them clearly distinguishable from the coalition, who have been very successful in finally repealing, carrying out a policy, which I guess nobody else has actually managed
absolutely,
to do.
Absolutely, but it's also very clever in the sense that when you tell the public, as Bill Shorten has done, that the Labor government will reintroduce pollution taxes in any event, probably an ETS scheme, which is where the carbon tax would have been anyway in around about 2016, you're making business, miners, companies realise that they've got to keep it still in their forward planning, and perhaps their annoyance over a period of time will turn not so much towards the Labor Party for reintroducing something that the rest of the world is probably going to be at anyway, but at the Liberal Party for providing such a disruption to the process.
I think you have a very big picture view of how business people perhaps
optimistic.
Regard their own best interests. Michaela Maguire, what do you make of the repeal and the politics around it?
Well, I think the politics has got in the way of the policy to a great
extent.
So
you agree with Sinclair?
Yeah, I do think so. Well, in some respects, maybe not all of them. I think it's been very easy to whittle this debate down to, you know, the dollar figure that it's supposedly going to save or cost families each year. And I think for a lot of families and voters, that has unfortunately been what swayed their opinion and then led them to the polls to vote on that issue. But going forward, I think it would be fantastic if a political party in Australia actually campaigned for something and for an emissions trading scheme rather than just campaigning against certain things. So hopefully in the future, the Labor Party will actually step up.
Well, Australia is now without any meaningful policy to tackle climate change. I'm wondering how this is being viewed internationally. Are people taking notice? Is this something we should be thinking about? Sinclair?
No, actually, I think we should pursue our own self-interest, and we should always pursue our own self-interest. And what I've been arguing for several years is that we should fully participate in a truly global international scheme. And until such a scheme is on the table, we should pursue our interests as we do. We do have a whole bunch of other policies about pollution, not a tax and not an ETS. And until everybody else does that, we should do nothing. Well, not nothing. We should continue doing what we are doing. And surprisingly, that was what Clive Palmer was saying last week with his extraordinary interview with Al Gore.
But I think what Jack would be saying is our best interests is served by being forward-looking.
Well, that is one view of it. Unfortunately, the political classes have been unable to convince the Australian electorate that that is our view. And we have to, government governs with the consent of the governed, and people don't want a standalone, go-it-alone approach to carbon pricing.
Mm. What if it takes 20 years or 30 years or 40 years or never happens, that there's a global unified approach to it?
That's the price that we pay for pursuing our own self-interests. We should not be undermining our own economic prosperity for the benefit of other people who are doing nothing to assist us in this whole issue. So if it takes 40 years, that's how long it takes. If it is as urgent as everybody suggests, it will take less than 40 years.
Mm. Well, after the name Clive Palmer was mentioned, after the shenanigans of last week, is this a win for the government? Are they coming out of this as the political winners, the people who finally achieved their great big goal? Jack Waterford.
Well, I think that Abbott deserves his triumph for what it's worth. But it's become very muddy in a number of respects. It's become muddy because the shenanigans of the last couple of weeks have probably persuaded the public that Clive Palmer is running the government in Australia, not Tony Abbott, and that the victory, if there's one, is Clive Palmer's. But apart from that, there's still this nagging question. As I say, there was a time, and it hasn't entirely passed, when most Australians wanted something done about climate change. Now, most of the current polls that show how unpopular, say, the carbon tax is, are somewhat confected by the questions that are being asked, etc. There's still, it seems, a majority of people who want something done. Just what that something is still a little bit vague and unclear. People who work on that conscience nerve, people who work on the is government planning for the long term, is government planning for our grandchildren, is government planning for the public good nerve, are eventually going to strike a real nerve in the Australian conscience, I think.
Mm. Well, we're going to move on quickly to boosting ASIO powers.
The ASIO Act is largely the 1979 Act, and it is in some respects obsolete. It predates the internet age.
In the past, we have rarely needed to collect intelligence on Australians overseas. But in the current operating environment, and you'll think Syria and Iraq particularly, there is a need to know what Australians are up to, particularly if they're going to come home and commit terrorist acts here in Australia.
Director General of ASIO David Irvine, and before that Attorney General George Brandis, this week announcing the long-awaited boost to ASIO powers. Michaela Maguire, do you acknowledge that we do need increased powers for our security people?
Well, I think any law that hasn't been updated for, what is it now, 34 years should certainly be revised. I don't necessarily agree that it should be pushed through legislation in as little as 2 months' time, which is what has been proposed. And I think specifically with this, there is a need to revise those security measures, but there's also a corresponding need to revise and put certain safeguards into place about what these increased security measures will actually mean to the privacy of most of the citizens in Australia. I think it's very important that that's looked at very closely, and I'm not sure if there's going to be the time to do that before this legislation is rushed through.
Sinclair Davidson, big thing, balancing safety of the community versus civil rights. I mean, what do you make of the proposals?
I'm always very suspicious of any proposal to increase the policing powers of the state. I think it's always disappointing that the first response that government comes up to with an alleged increased terrorism threat is that they will increase the surveillance of otherwise law-abiding citizens, where they get to check our emails, our selfies, and according to Edward Snowden, our porn collections. How this makes us safer, I just don't know. And I would certainly hope that the Senate would look very closely at any proposals to increase the surveillance powers of the state and be inclined to say no rather than yes. Unfortunately, our politicians tend to be gutless around these sorts of issues, and I would look first to increasing the penalties for acts of terrorism rather than surveillance powers of the state. So, yeah, I'm a bit more suspicious about this.
Jack Waterford in Canberra, I know your paper has a long association with people who break stories.
Leaking aside for just a second, but I think I'm against Sinclair in a sort of a way here. I think we've got to look at our own national interest here. Now, we do need checks and balances against excessive surveillance and against, if you like, a national security culture. But I think we could introduce some checks and balances in a new and novel way that would work well. There's a major threat to our national interest also coming from tax dodging. And I think if we gave the Commissioner for Tax the identical powers that we're giving to the Director General of ASIO and allowed tax evasion and tax avoidance, particularly international tax avoidance, to be treated in exactly the same way as national security threats to the country, we'd suddenly find from the squawks of the business interests in Australia something more approaching real checks and balances than that we currently get, while checks and balances is just a question for the, quote, chattering classes.
And on the leaks, I mean, do you think there could be an impact on whistleblowing and freedom of the press?
I have no doubt that there will, and I don't think it will be a good impact. I don't think it will be a good impact for the public or on government. This is not a government seriously constrained by or handicapped by the leaks that have occurred in the past, neither by the WikiLeaks nor the Snowden leaks. In fact, it is very hard to make a case, even during Cold War times, that compulsive and obsessive secrecy of government has ever contributed anything to the national security. It's hard to think of an intelligence operation that proved to be better because it was conceived in and conducted in secrecy. And it's easy to think of lots of them that went spectacularly bad because of that obsessive secrecy.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Jack Waterford, Editor-in-Chief of the Canberra Times, Sinclair Davidson, Economics Professor at RMIT University, and Michaela Maguire, writer, author and co-curator of Women of Letters. Thank you so much for being on Outsiders today.
Thank you.